His skin was almost purple-black, the scar a livid pink upon it. He was short in stature, but with broad shoulders and muscular limbs. He wore a tattered shirt and shorts of faded khaki drill that were crusted and stained with sweat and filth. He had obviously travelled hard, for his bare legs were floured with dust to the knees. In the heat he stank of stale sweat, a goaty and rancid odour that made Cheng draw away fastidiously. The gesture was not wasted on the poacher, and his smile broadened into a genuine grin. "Where are you men?" Cheng demanded, and Sali prodded his thumb towards the dense encircling bush. "You are armed?" he insisted, and Sali's grin became insolent. He did not deign to reply to such a fatuous question. Cheng realized that relief and nervousness had made him garrulous. He determined to contain himself, but the next question slipped out before he could prevent it. "You know what has to be done." With a fingertip, Sali rubbed the glossy streak of scar tissue down his cheek and nodded. "You are to leave no witnesses." Cheng saw from his eyes that the poacher had not understood. So he repeated. "You must kill them all. When the police come, there must be no one for them to talk to." Sali inclined his head in agreement. Chetty Singh had explained to him in detail. The orders had been agreeable. Sali had a bitter feud against the Zimbabwe Parks Department. Only a year previously, Sali's two younger brothers had crossed the Zambezi with a small group of men to hunt rhinoceros. They had run into one of the park's anti-poaching units, who were all ex-guerrilla fighters and armed, like them, with AK-47 assault rifles. In the fierce firefight that ensued, one of his brothers had been killed and the other shot through the spine and crippled for life. Despite his wound, they had brought him to trial in Harare, and he had been sentenced to 7 years' imprisonment. Thus, Sali the poacher felt no great affection for the park's rangers, and it showed in his expression as he agreed, "We will leave nobody." "Except the two rangers," Cheng qualified the threat, "Gomo and David. You know them?"
"I know them." Sali had worked with them before.
"They will be at the workshops with the two big trucks. Make sure all your men understand that they are not to touch them or damage the trucks in any way."
"I will tell them."
"The warden will be in his office. His wife and their three children are at the bungalow on the hill. There are four camp servants and their families in the domestic compound. Make sure it's surrounded before you open fire. Nobody must get away."
"You chatter like a monkey in a wild plum tree," Sali told him scornfully.
"I know these things. Chetty Singh has told me."
"Then go and do as you have been told,"
Cheng ordered sharply. And Sali leaned in through the Mercedes window, forcing the Chinaman to hold his breath and draw away from him. Sali rubbed his thumb and forefinger together in the universal sign for money. Cheng reached across and opened the cubby hole in the Mercedes dashboard. The $10 bills were in bundles of 100, each secured by a rubber band. He counted them into Sali's open hand, 3 bundles of $1,000 each. It would work out to approximately $5 a kilo for the vast store of ivory in the camp warehouse, ivory that would be worth $1,000 a kilo in Taipei. On the other hand, to Sali, the sheaves of green bills represented an enormous fortune. He had never in his entire life held that amount of money in his hand at one time. His usual reward for poaching a good elephant, for risking his life against the anti-poaching teams by penetrating deep into forbidden territory, for risking his life again by firing at the great beasts with the light bullets of the AK-47, for cutting out the tusks and carrying their galling weight back over heavy broken ground, his usual reward for all that risk and labour amounted to around $30 an elephant killed, say $1 a kilo. The treasury bills that Cheng placed in his hands represented the reward he could expect from 5 years of hard and dangerous labour. So compared to that, what was the killing of a few parks officials and their families? It entailed very little additional effort and minimal risk. For $3,000 it would be a pleasure indeed. Both men were mightily pleased with their bargain. "I will wait here until I hear the guns," Cheng told him delicately. And Sali smiled so broadly that he showed all his large, brilliant white teeth right to the wisdoms in the back of his jaw.
"You will not have long to wait," he promised.
and then as silently as he had appeared, he vanished back into the bush. Daniel Armstrong drove at a sedate pace. The road was fairly good by Central African standards. It was graded regularly, for few of the visitors to the park drove four-wheel drive vehicles. Nevertheless, Daniel was in no hurry and did not push it. His Toyota was equipped with a full range of camping equipment. He never stayed at motels or other formal lodgings if he could avoid them. Not only were they few and far between in this country, but in most cases the food and comforts they offered were much below the standard that Daniel could provide in his own temporary camps. This evening he would keep going until a little before sunset, and then find some inviting stand of forest or pleasant stream at which to pull well off the road and break out the tucker box and Chivas bottle. He doubted that they would get as far as Mana Pools, and certainly they would not reach the main metalled highway that ran from the Chirundu Bridge on the Zambezi south to Karoi and Harare. Jock was pleasant company. It was one of the reasons that Daniel had hired him. They had worked together on and off over the past 5 years. Jock was a freelance cameraman, and Daniel called him up on contract whenever he had a new project signed up and financed. They had covered huge tracts of Africa together, from the forbidding beaches of the Skeleton Coast in Namibia to the drought and famine-ravaged mountains and umbers of Ethiopia and the depths of the Sahara. Although they had not succeeded in forging a deep or committed friendship, they had spent weeks together in the remote wilderness, and there had seldom been any friction between them. They chatted amicably as Daniel took the heavily laden truck down the twisting escarpment road. And whenever a bird or animal or unusual tree caught their attention, Daniel parked the truck and made notes and observations while Jock filmed. Before they had covered 20 miles, they came to a section of the road over which a large herd of elephant had fed during the previous night. They had pulled down branches and pushed over many of the large mapani trees. Some of these had fallen across the roadway, blocking it entirely. From those trees still standing, they had stripped the bark, leaving the trunks naked white and weeping with sap. "Naughty beggars," Daniel grinned as he contemplated the destruction. "They seemed to delight in blocking the roads." Yet it was a clear demonstration, if any were needed, that regular culling of the herds was absolutely necessary. The Mopani forest could survive only a limited amount of this destructive feeding. They were able to pull off the road and detour around many of the fallen trees, although once or twice they were forced to hitch up a tree trunk to the Toyota's tow chain and bodily haul it aside before they could pass. Thus it was after 4 o'clock before they reached the valley bottom and turned eastwards through the Mopani forest towards the Mana Pools turnoff, near which they had filmed the elephant cull. At this stage, both of them were engrossed in a discussion of how best Daniel could edit the huge volume of film that they had now on tape. Daniel was experiencing the heightened anticipation he always felt at this stage of a production. It was all in the can. Now he could return to London, where, in a hired editing room at Castle Film Studios, he would spend long weeks and months sequestered in a dark room, absorbed in the exacting but infinitely rewarding labour of cutting each scene into the next and composing the commentary to support it. Even though the forefront of his mind was focused on what Jock was saying, he was fully aware of his surroundings. Nevertheless, he almost missed it. He drove over it and went on for almost 200 yards before it fully registered that he had passed something unusual. Perhaps it was a relic of his experiences during the Bush War, when any extraneous mark on the roadway could give warning of a landmine and violent death buried in the tracks. In those days, he would have been much quicker to register and react, but the intervening years had blunted his reflexes. He braked the truck, and Jock broke off what he was saying and glanced at him quizzically. "What is it?" "I don't know." Daniel swiveled in the seat as he reversed the Land Cruiser down the track. "Probably nothing," he murmured, but there was a tiny niggling doubt in the back of his mind. He stopped and pulled on the handbrake and climbed down out of the cab. "I can't see anything." Jock hung out of the window on the far side. "Oh, that's just it," Daniel agreed. There's a blank spot here." He pointed down the dusty roadway, whose surface was dimpled and pocked by the marvellous graffiti of the bush. The tiny V-shaped spurs of francolin and other birds, the serpentine tracks of insects and lizards, the larger hoof prints of various species of antelope and hare, Mongoose and jackal were woven into an intricate tapestry of sign, except at one point in the roadway where the soft surface was smooth and unblemished. Daniel squatted beside it and studied it for a moment. "Somebody swept sign," he said. "So what's so bloody extraordinary about that?" Jock climbed down out of the truck and came to join him. "Oh, nothing, perhaps," he stood up. "Or everything. Depends on how you look at it." "Shoot?" Jock invited him. "Well, only human beings cover their tracks, and only when they're up to no good. Besides that, there aren't supposed to be people wandering around on foot in the middle of a national park." Daniel skirted the area of soft earth that had been carefully swept with a leafy branch and stepped off the track into the stand of tussocked grass on the verge. Immediately he saw other signs of anti-tracking. The grass clumps had been crushed and flattened as a party of men on foot had used them as stepping stones. It seemed to be a large party, and Daniel felt the hair on his forearms and at the back of his neck prickle and lift. "Contact," he thought. It was like the old days with the scouts when they first picked up the sign of a group of guerrilla terrorists. He experienced that same breathless feeling of excitement and the same stone of fear heavy in his bowels. It took an effort to thrust those feelings aside. Those dangerous days were long past. Still, he followed the sign. Although the chase had taken some elementary precautions, they were perfunctory. A Qaeda of ZANU in the war days would have been more professional. Within 50 yards of the road, Daniel found the first clear print of a shod human foot, and a few yards further on, the band had joined a narrow game track and formed up in Indian file, abandoning all further attempts at anti-tracking. They had struck out in the direction of the escarpment and Chiwewe base camp with determined stride. Daniel was amazed to find how large the band was. He counted the tracks of between 16 and 20 individuals in the group. After following them another 200 or 300 yards, Daniel stopped and thought about it carefully. Considering the size of the group and the direction from which they had come, the most obvious assumption was that they were a band of Zambian poachers who had crossed the Zambezi River on a raid for ivory and rhino horn. That would also explain the precautions they had taken to cover their tracks. What he should do now was to warn Johnny Inzu so that he could get an anti-poaching unit in as fast as possible for a follow-up action. Daniel pondered the best way to do this. There was a telephone in the ranger's office at Mana Pools, only an hour's drive ahead. Or Daniel could turn back to Chiwewe headquarters and take the warning in person. The decision was made for him as he made out the line of telephone poles in the forest not far ahead. These were cut from native timber and steeped in black creosote to discourage the attack of termites. Between the poles, the draped copper telephone wires gleamed in the late sunlight, except between two of the poles directly ahead. Daniel hurried forward and then stopped abruptly. The telephone wires had been cut and dangled from the white ceramic insulators at the top of the nearest pole. Daniel reached out for the end of one wire and peered at it. There was no question about it. It had been deliberately cut. The shear marks made by the cutting edge of a pair of pliers were evident in the malleable red metal of the cable. There were the milling tracks of many men at the base of the pole. Now why the hell would a poacher want to cut the telephone lines? Daniel wondered aloud, and his sense of unease turned to alarm. This begins to look really ugly. I have to warn Johnny. He has to get onto these gentlemen damn quickly. Only one way to warn him now. At a run, he started back to where he had left the Land Cruiser. What the hell's going on? Jock wanted to know as he jumped up into the cab and started the motor. I don't know, but I don't like it, whatever it is, Daniel told him as he reversed off the road and then swung back onto it, headed in the opposite direction. Daniel drove fast now, ripping up a long bank of dust behind the Land Cruiser, slowing only for the fords through the deep, dry watercourses and then accelerating away again. As he drove, it occurred to him that the gang could reach the headquarters camp by cutting across the loop that the road made down the pass of the escarpment. It would be a steep climb up onto the plateau, but on foot they could cut almost 30 miles off the longer route that Daniel was forced to follow. He estimated that the telephone lines had been cut about 5 or 6 hours earlier. He arrived at that estimate by a process of fieldcraft deduction, which included a study of the erosion of the spoor and the recovery time of trodden-down grass and vegetation. He could not think of any reason why a gang of poachers should want to visit Chiwewe headquarters. On the contrary, he would expect them to give it the widest possible berth. However, their tracks were headed resolutely in that direction, and they had cut the telephone wires too. Their conduct was brazen and aggressive. If Chiwewe was indeed their destination, then they could be there already. He glanced at his wristwatch. Yes, they could have climbed the escarpment and, by hard marching, have reached the headquarters camp an hour or so ago. But why? There were no tourists. In Kenya and other countries further north, the poachers, having depleted the elephant herds, had taken to attacking and robbing foreign tourists. Perhaps this gang had taken a tip from their northern counterparts. But there are no tourists at Chiwewe. There's nothing of value. He broke off as the fallacy of that assumption occurred to him. Shit, he whispered. The ivory. Suddenly, dread chilled the sweat on his cheeks. Johnny, he whispered. Johnny and Mavis and the kids. The Land Cruiser was flying down the track now, and he slid her into the first hairpin bend that led onto the slope of the escarpment. As he came through the corner at speed, a huge white vehicle filled the road directly ahead of him. Even as Daniel hit the brakes and swung the Toyota hard over, he realized that it was one of the refrigerator trucks. He missed its front wing by a foot as he went up onto the verge and tore into a patch of scrub. He came to rest with the nose of the Toyota almost touching the trunk of a big Mapani. Jock was thrown up against the dashboard by the deceleration. Daniel jumped out of the Toyota and ran back to where the refrigerator truck had managed to pull up, blocking his tailgate. He recognized Gomo, the senior ranger, at the wheel, and called to him. "Sorry, my fault. Are you okay?" Gomo looked shaken by the near collision, but he nodded. I am okay, doctor." "When did you leave Chiwewe?" Daniel demanded, and Gomo hesitated. For some reason, the question seemed to disconcert him. "How long ago?" Daniel insisted. I don't know for sure." At that moment, there was the sound of other vehicles approaching down the escarpment road, and Daniel glanced around to see the second truck come grinding through the next bend. It was running in low gear to combat the gravity of the steep gradient. 50 yards behind the truck followed Ambassador Ning Cheng Gong's blue Mercedes. The two vehicles slowed and then pulled up behind Gomo's truck, and Daniel strode towards the Mercedes. As he approached, Ambassador Ning opened his door and stepped out into the dusty track. "Dr. Armstrong! What are you doing here?" He seemed agitated, but his voice was soft, barely audible. "When did you leave Chiwewe?" Daniel ignored the question. He was desperate to know that Johnny and Mavis were safe, and the ambassador's reaction puzzled him. Cheng's agitation increased. "Why do you ask that? Why are you returning? You are supposed to be on your way to Harare." "Look here, Your Excellency, all I want to know is that there has been no trouble at Chiwewe." "Trouble? What trouble? Why should there be trouble?" The ambassador reached into his pocket and brought out a handkerchief.